Welcome to a special episode of the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee. We have our CEO, Nate Pearson, with us, and we have a special guest today that we haven't had on the podcast before. His name is Kyle Pfaffenbach, and Kyle has an undergrad in exercise science, a master's in exercise science and nutrition from Colorado State, a PhD in nutritional biochemistry from Colorado State, postdoctoral fellowship in cancer and molecular biology at USC Tech School of Medicine. He's currently an associate professor in health and human performance at Eastern Oregon University, and where he teaches a variety of different health and exercise nutrition classes. It's fair to say that Kyle is also a nutrition coach to the stars, between the Brooks Beast on the running side and then even our own very own Keegan Swenson, that has appeared on the podcast many times, and many other professional endurance athletes. Kyle, it's awesome to have you on the podcast. Thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. We have listener submitted questions that we want to get to, but at the same time, they're also just like questions that we just want to chat with you. And I think it'll be really informative. Nate, do you want to just open the floodgates here?
Let's go through it. And then I'll just do it as they come up, because I'm sure they
sounds
will.
Sounds good. Okay, cool. All right. So the first one came in, and this is from Jack. You can submit these questions at trainerroad.com/podcast, or you can submit them on Spotify. Just go and find it on Spotify, and there's an easy spot to enter your questions right there. It's super cool. And Jack actually submitted this question to the podcast. Now, these first two questions are kind of related. So Kyle, I'm going to read both of them and then we'll go through there. But Jack says, like many listeners, I have young children whose schedules make my only available training time after 8:30 PM. Nutrition and for these sessions can be difficult both pre and post. Do you have any advice? And then Jordan says, this is a bit more detail to that question, but we'll cover both. Says, love the podcast and Trainer Road. The new features are awesome, and I'm excited for some of the new stuff coming. I often struggle with hitting my macros when life happens on workout days, and it's not uncommon for me to look at the food tracker at the end of the day and realize I'm behind, usually on protein. Often I'll pound a protein shake to make up for it, but I've found that this can disrupt my sleep if it's too close to bed. Obviously, the ideal solution would just be to plan out my day better, but short of that, is it better to hit my protein macro or go without to ensure good sleep and make it up the next day? And then there's additional question here about suggestions on fast protein outside of a shake, which we can get to later. But Kyle, this whole feeding late in the evening thing, and it's like my worst nightmare when I can't, and I haven't done my workout yet, and it's like 7 PM. And then I know that after that workout, I have to fuel. What do you suggest for athletes on how to fuel pre and post on late evening workouts, considering they still have to sleep?
Yeah. This is super. There's so many layers to Jack's question. Jack's my son's name, by the way. So shout out to all the Jacks out there. So there's a couple layers to this that I thought of when I first saw it. So first, we have to take into consideration what's called the chronotype of the individual. So chronotype refers to what rhythm of the 24-hour cycle the individual is on. So we run on a circadian rhythm, which is roughly 24 hours. We're all aware of this, right? We hear a lot about light exposure and pre-bed light exposure and all these different things. Now, some people are morning people and they literally are like genetically built like that. Some people are not and they aren't. And so they have a different kind of clock that is affected in different ways by artificial and natural light. So the first thing you have to consider is like, what is this doing to your training quality? Is it something that where everything is so busy with getting the kids to school in the morning and all these different types of things that this is your only window to train? Or would you be better off waking up early and getting your work in at that time, regardless of how it is? So that's the first question you kind of have to ask yourself. If you can't get up in the morning, that's fine. It's not always just about being disciplined and whatever. Like a lot of people, it just doesn't work for them. And the later evening workouts work better. The second thing you have to consider is like, especially if you're doing high intensity work and you're putting that off until the evening, you sort of have to take into consideration the level that activates your sympathetic nervous system. And there's going to be a post-exercise period after that, that's going to be required to come down before you can fall asleep. There's just too much sympathetic activation and sort of catabolic processes going on. And it's going to take your body a little bit of time to like switch into that relaxation mode. Feeding can help and different things that can signals that can put you into parasympathetic and get you to sleep. But that's one of the things that you kind of have to consider is, am I going to come down for this? Or is this going to wake me up and I'm going to want to like stay up and work and read and do other stuff at that point? And then the third major point with this is the relationship between performance and effort, particularly rate of perceived exertion or RPE. So how hard the exercise feels and how that's, synced with your circadian clock, because our hormones are tied to our circadian clock. So for example, in the evening, melatonin comes up, cortisol is going down throughout the day, and we can go to sleep at night because we have high melatonin, lower cortisol, you know, we relax, growth hormone goes up, insulin's down, and this is how we sleep. In the morning, you know, we get light exposure, it activates retinal cells that suppress melatonin, and cortisol starts to come up. And this is how we like come out of the sleep state and get awake briefly. Like, just that's a quick, very, very quick explanation of it. And so what the studies suggest is that there's a group of people that somewhere mid-morning have their best performance and their lowest RPE for a given workload, right? So if you do the exact same workout at various times throughout the day, it's going to feel different depending on when that workout takes place for different people. There's a group of athletes that seem to thrive in the 10 to noon sort of time range. And then there's a group of athletes that seem to thrive in like the 3 to 5 range. Okay. And Nate's raising his hand. Yeah. And so,
like, so much validation right now.
Yeah.
That you don't have to get up at 5 a.m. to do your workouts and just
Exactly.
Start normal. Yeah, because people feel guilty, like they're not tough because the 7 a.m. workout feels so bad.
And this is something that is like a cornerstone of kind of my approach, and especially when it comes to nutrition, is like not in like a kumbaya, we're all special kind of bit. We're literally unique biological organisms, each one of us. And so there's such a culture around like you're a failure if you don't get up super early in the morning. It's just not, that's not the way people are built. And the people that prophesize that are typically built that way. And so they try it, they respond well to it, and then they want everybody to do it because they were a responder. And there's no room to appreciate that different people respond to different situations, environments.
And they kind of do it in almost like a pious way of like, I am better than you.
It has an air of that. It often does have an air of that, right? Like, is it even worth getting out of bed if you haven't been up before the sun, taking your cold plunge?
Somehow also like you're supposed to, within the first 20 minutes when you wake up, you're supposed to get natural sunlight, but you're supposed to wake up at 4 a.m.
Exactly. Exactly. So, yeah. And it's different because this is something I'm really interested in, but these rhythms actually change seasonally. So you're on a different cycle at different times of the year, et cetera, et cetera. And so the point with this is that you first want to consider all these things. One is, okay, is this the only time I have to work out? If it is, then it's the only time you have to work out and you have to do it. But you can't beat yourself up if your numbers aren't tracking or your body isn't responding in the same way as it was when you were 22 and didn't have kids and trained in the middle of the day and got 10 hours of sleep at night. And so it's really important to sort of take those things into consideration. If you have to do it, you have to do it. But also sort of be prepared for that sympathetic bump and possibly a disruption in sleep and an increase in rate of perceived exertion if it's not in the time window that your sort of circadian clock is timed up for.
Kyle, was this have to do with, I remember like the Beijing Olympics and the swimmers and like their meets were always like, I think in the morning or something, and they adjusted it to the afternoon. And there was a huge deal about them doing that. And I would think that maybe that these swimmers, because I bet the best people already had their rhythm set up that way. So therefore they were the most successful and they had to move everybody in a different time zone. And I remember they're trying to do things to improve that. I don't know any details, but is that related to this?
Yeah. So I don't know that anecdote specifically, but it sounds normal. Okay, so like I'll go to the beach. So I work with this professional track team. They're really high level runners, 14 of them, and they're all, I don't know, like within the top 10 in the country. And so the majority.
Wow.
This is actually really interesting. So they train right around 10:30 Their RTG is usually 10:45 or 11, so their warm up starts around 10, and then they train right in that period. And it's a really nice period for a lot of athletes. A lot of athletes respond well to it. And actually, when we look at kind of the diurnal rhythms of some of the hormones, we actually see cortisol and testosterone higher during that period of time and lower later in the afternoon, which is super interesting. And now, when you get to like big international competitions and even some like Portland Track Fest, even some of these things, the time can change. You could be running at 6 p.m., but you normally train it. And so you sort of have to decide, like, there's a couple things that you can do. One, do you take a couple weeks to start training when that race is and try and schedule that in? They're professional athletes. It's all they have to do. So if they need to train in the evening, they can. The other thing that really helps is having very normal nutritional timing around what your workout is. You know, Jack has to work out at 8:30. It would behoove him to get a schedule around that 8:30 workout time. Even if it's not ideal, his body will adapt from a circadian standpoint to that. The body will start to expect, oh, we do this effort 90 minutes after we eat this type of food and it digests and gets through the system. Does this make sense? You can create rhythms. And even if it's not perfectly matched with your genetic chronotype, your body will adapt to some degree. Like, I'm not a morning person. I have to wake up at 6 o'clock to get my kids ready for school. It sucks, but I'm used to it because I do it every day. And so at some level I'm used to it, but if I could just choose my own schedule, you know, when they're not in school and I can sleep later and train whenever I want in the summertime, when I'm teaching just online classes, I do way better than when I'm on a more restricted schedule.
Kyle, I feel like I'm in school because I'm literally, this is so awesome. I'm raising my hand like, I have questions. I have questions. I know we're not there yet, but this is amazing. So when you do that, does that then impact your cortisol also, where like it might spike then based on that meal? Or how does it then, how does your body know based on your meal, how does it change to be able to work out harder if you have a lower RPE?
Yeah, so cortisol is tricky because it does a lot of stuff. Cortisol is diurnal, but it's also acute. And so if you were just perfectly relaxed and you followed your cortisol over 24 hours, it would go up and down based on time, light exposure, time of day, your circadian rhythm. But then we don't just lay in bed all day doing nothing. And so if you get stressed, if you train, if you do these different things, cortisol also goes up in an acute sense and it can help. If cortisol is too elevated too often for too long, that's when it becomes detrimental. So that's when it starts to be give us an indication of like, maybe this person is in the early stages of overreaching. Maybe they're in frank overtraining, right? It will disrupt sleep. It will do these different things. Now, it's really individual how different nutrients impact cortisol. So that isn't so much of the role. It's more of when I eat particular nutrients at certain times, I have a variety of hormonal responses that are, from a central nervous system standpoint, tied to this is what I eat when I train. And so I'm sort of, from a central nervous system standpoint, to a certain degree, getting ready for training and getting ready for. So if you eat like a really high carbohydrate meal, for example, 90 minutes before at 7 o'clock, if he has a high carbohydrate meal, it's time to hit for him to start his warm up, Jack to start his warm up at 8:30. That insulin curve will have gone up and come back down. The carbohydrates that he consumed will have been kind of stored in muscle glycogen and different things like that. And then he starts a warm up, a light warm up to get a little bit of cortisol to turn on epinephrine, to turn on that sympathetic nervous system. That's taken all together when it occurs at the same time every 24 hours. Your body starts to create a rhythm around that. It may not be absolutely ideal for Jack, but it would be, those are the things that he can control within the constraints of his schedule. And those are the things that he could do to optimize this.
It's like a Pavlovian response. Your body's like, oh, ding, ding, ding. It's time to do it. What are your thoughts? I took a at-home cortisol test where it was like Everly Well, and I took it like 4 or 5 times per day.
Yeah,
I brought it in. Mine was opposite. It was really high in the evening. I love to train at 3, but also my kids come home in the evening too. So that could be a tied to that also. If athletes want to test this themselves, like you said, it can be acute, right? Like individual factors in a day can spike it. What would you recommend them taking it? Are these tests accurate? Or do you?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a couple things. One is there are saliva tests that may be the one that you did. Yeah, typically, if an endocrinologist wants information about your cortisol, they do a urine test. That's probably the most accurate way, as far as my understanding is. Blood cortisol level is a little bit tricky to interpret. You have to be really careful when you're interpreting blood cortisol, because it's a pretty easy test to get. You can get on athlete blood test and get your cortisol tested. But morning cortisol is typically the highest, typically. And there's actually a thing called the cortisol awakening response, or CAR. So it's interesting, because if an athlete is suspected of being overtrained and then you do a morning cortisol blood test, in my opinion, this probably isn't interpreted the same way from everybody, but in my opinion, if the cortisol is out of the upper range, it's actually a good sign, because it means you're still making cortisol in the morning and trying to turn on and compensate, when what you see in people that are completely fried is really low cortisol in the morning. And it's kind of a sign that the adrenal gland is just sort of given up at this point in time. It needs to recover. Because the idea is that, like, I'm not even going to try and overcome this anymore. And so that cortisol awakening response is important. Now, what's really interesting with what you're saying, Nate, is you did this from a saliva standpoint. It can give you really useful information, like you found, and your cortisol is up in the afternoon. Be really interesting to know if your testosterone was up with it, and then you already know your rate of perceived exertion and your quality of training is better in the afternoon. And just having those insights are really important. What would be interesting to see is, like, how much your genetic and just sort of base material, like your base system, would be able to adapt if you didn't have kids and you were just able to do whatever you wanted. Because if you could sleep until...
We all dream of that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, in some ways, yeah, for sure, right? And so, but we see this in the runners, especially that come from college. The vast, vast majority of college athletes, track and field athletes, train in the afternoon. Well, the beasts train at 10 a.m. And there is... like, I don't know, 4 to 6 month lag typically, where it's like, I'm just not popping like I did in, this is anecdotal, but the research is really, I mean, that example is anecdotal. The research is there though. This is for heat. This is for performance. This is for, if you set a workload and set the environmental conditions and do it at different times of the day for different people, they have different rates of perceived exertion. It's very cool.
We're so early on this. I have one more question. So for circadian rhythm, I read that some people could be more than 24 hours. And it kind of like messes your system up, because you maybe wake up a little bit later, but then you're not tired at the same time. And then with alarm clocks and schedules and like doing this early podcast, you just get more tired and more tired. Then you have to have like a day off and you sleep. Like, right? That's a
100%. John, I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there is this where they say it's like roughly, and I'm not a circadian rhythm expert. I have to be very clear. Like, there's a lot of really good, one of my colleagues, Andrew Miller at OHSU, and one of my classmates that we kind of crossed paths at some point in Colorado State, who works for the Navy now. Her name is Rachel Markwald. They're like the leaders in these sleep sciences. I just like am interested in it. And I think me kind of boning up on that research and learning about it has really helped the especially with traveling and going to Europe to race and doing all these different things. And so I've become really interested in it. Articles I read basically say, like, it's roughly 24 hours, right? But some people are on different clocks, and it changes depending on what stage of life you're in. So kids are different, teenagers are different, old people are different, middle age is different. And this is one of those things where, like, one of the biggest injustices to our youth is that they all have to start school super early, even in high school. And there's not a late start option for kids that have to sleep later, because they like have to stay up later and they have to sleep in later. And when you stay up later and get up early, you accumulate sleep debt really, really quickly. And so, some people aren't on this. Artificial light and living in houses and using screens, affects this in ways that I don't think we fully comprehended. You know, there's a study out of University of Colorado from a couple of years ago, which was really cool, where they took early risers and late risers in like modern society, and they took them out camping for 2 weeks. And they measured their melatonin onset. And so for people that don't want to go to bed until later, they have what's called delayed onset melatonin. And so their melatonin comes on later. And then once your melatonin comes on, there is usually like an 8 to 10 hour period. So like if you don't fall asleep until, you know, 1 or 2, like if you have to wake up at 7, your melatonin is still up there. Like it hasn't come down naturally like it was supposed to. And what was interesting was that the night owl group, they call them night owls and early risers, the night owl group, when they were away from light, actually adjusted their melatonin onset to go with the sun along with the early risers. And it was super interesting because it was almost like that gene never got beat out of us because it was never an issue because we never had artificial light. That was my interpretation of it.
Wow.
And so now we introduce artificial light and we have this genetic polymorphism that under this specific condition that we didn't evolve with, so that gene never got edited out for any reason, now affects like a significant portion of the population.
That's crazy. Wait, so I have some more questions. Other than like international travel, where you're going to change time zones, because someone's going to hear like melatonin and they're going to probably start being like, I should take 10 grams of melatonin before I go to bed.
Yeah.
I wanted to let you touch on that because, I'll just let you talk.
Yeah. So there is a consensus in the literature that melatonin is safe at about 5 to 10 milligrams. It's non-habit forming. It doesn't seem to impact melatonin release. That said, I'm not a big fan of athletes supplementing with, this is again, my personal opinion. I'm not a big fan of athletes supplementing with melatonin. There's a couple reasons for this. One, the bioavailability melatonin is released by the pineal gland in our brain in response to light exposure and different things in time. And so it comes from our brain and it's sort of, that's where it's released. And so taking it orally, there's just a bunch of logistical issues with that. So you have to get it, you know, in your mouth, down your esophagus, through your stomach, into your small intestine, into your portal circulation, through your liver, out into your systemic circulation, and then off to tissues that it can affect. And a variety of tissues have melatonin receptors, which is pretty interesting. It suggests that other tissues have a circadian rhythm that maybe needs to be explored more and things like that. So that's just an aside. That's interesting to me. Anyways, so the bioavailability of a certain amount of melatonin is highly variable. So if someone, if the three of us each take 10 milligrams of melatonin, I may end up absorbing 2 of it. Nate may get 9 of it and Jonathan may get 5 of it or whatever. Like, so the variability varies greatly in terms of its bioavailability. So that's the first thing that I can't really control. So I don't know what's happening. The second thing is that it's a really powerful kind of exogenous hormone. It does a lot of things. And I don't think we fully understand the impact of taking it, even though clinically it is like safe for a normal person to take. And studies are, I wouldn't go as far as say equivocal, I'd say it slightly tips to, it helps people sleep, even if it's partly a placebo. But based on my analysis, it just doesn't make sense for athletes because we don't know the rate at which they clear it, all these different types of things. I think controlling light exposure and handling bedtime are better, like your sleep schedule, taking care of your sleep hygiene and controlling light exposure, I think are the ways I'd rather people regulate their circadian clock.
I was going to ask a question, but I swear, Kyle, we could spend 17 hours just talking about this. So like,
no, this is good. We haven't covered this very much on the podcast, so keep going.
I'm going to ask a question on this. So
yeah. And
I've heard just this is not scientific at all, but okay. I've heard discussions that people have had about taking melatonin and having a rebound effect where if they take too much, boom, they wake up or it causes them to feel more awake than they would be otherwise. And this is something that I've heard anecdotally just from individuals.
After 3 or 4 hours. Yeah. I think it was actually, there's science behind that. I think
Yeah, and sure. I looked into research on that and I couldn't find any research on it. Are you familiar with this concept?
I'm not.
Melatonin supplementation?
No. That's really interesting though.
I heard an even more concerning use case for that was that from a college student who said, yeah, no, like none of us take like any sort of like we don't take a bunch of Adderall or anything else because all that stuff's really bad for you. So instead we just take like insane amounts of melatonin and then that helps us stay wired and it's totally safe because it's melatonin. And I was like, there's probably a lot of stepping back that needs to happen before that's like, you know, I guess assume that it's safe.
Yeah. But, I mean, so it's crazy. Like if you look at, and again, this is not my like real field of expertise, but I am interested in it. And the studies that I've looked at, so in terms of the safety of it, it is super safe. Like that's undeniable. I have to be careful using such absolute language. It at this point appears to be a very, very safe non-habit forming, it doesn't seem to like reduce the amount of melatonin that people make naturally when you take melatonin, which is really interesting that it's not susceptible to normal feedback loops, right? If I start taking a bunch of growth hormone or I start taking a bunch of testosterone, my endogenous production of those things goes way down. And because of feedback loops, negative feedback loops. So melatonin, at least at this point, my understanding is it doesn't seem to work in that way. The other thing that's interesting about it is that we don't, I don't know what the mechanism of that would be or why, what the dose response would be or what other tissues are being affected at that level that would give that effect. I'm just not familiar with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's in the book, Why We Sleep.
Really?
I think that's where I read it. I can't remember.
I've personally experienced it, but that was because I had only taken like 1 milligram of melatonin and like really small doses. And then I accidentally got a bottle. And I didn't realize it was 10. And I took 10 and I remember I was like, nice, I'm going to sleep on this red eye. And after 30 minutes of being asleep, I was so awake for the rest of the flight. Just nothing.
That's
to do,
crazy. You know? Yeah, that's so, really interesting.
But who knows if that was the cause or if it was something else.
Yeah, if it's something else. Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know. We'd have to ask someone that like knows what they're talking about with melatonin for sure.
I want to get into the, because lacing in Jordan's question into this, and we're talking about like I liked how you talked about taking a high carbohydrate meal prior to at some sort of consistent schedule, because then you can give your body these signals that allows it to be prepared to train late despite the less than ideal circumstances that you may just be forced to live within. Mm-hmm. Now, when we're talking about post-workout and what to do post-workout, I think a lot of athletes misunderstand how many calories they burn and how much you can replenish during the activity. You know, if an athlete has anything that's like a 200 watt FTP or above, you know, in most cases, if they're doing an endurance workout or greater, even if they drank 90 grams of carbs an hour, they would be, you know, at best zeroing out, but they're likely putting themselves into a hole. So after workout, working out late, knowing that you're going to have to sleep again, is it the typical just taking the 4-to-1 carbs to protein ratio and just if it messes up your sleep, that's fine? Or what do you recommend?
This is interesting. So one of the reasons, so first of all, chrononutrition is really important. So the timing and the time that we eat is really important. So the time of day that you eat your meals, the composition of those meals helps you with your circadian rhythms, right? So we know that. And actually, this is one of the strategies we employ when athletes are traveling to Europe, for example, is they shift when they eat during the day, and it helps immensely when they arrive. So you shift your meals to closer to meal times when you at your destination. And it's a huge pain because a lot of times you're waking up in the middle of the night for like a sandwich and then going back to bed. But so it's pretty interesting in that way. But it helps immensely. Okay, and then let me back up because this is tied to Jordan's question as well, which is that there are several studies, particularly in young, hard training male populations, that taking pre-bedtime protein is really quite beneficial to recovery. So when you take a mixed whole protein, so it's got all 20 amino acids, like a whey protein or something like that, that also has plenty of branched chain amino acids as well as leucine. The protein itself is a signal to turn on protein synthesis, But if you take it without sugar, you can avoid the insulin spike that comes along with it, because insulin and sleep don't work all that great together. It's interesting because insulin makes us feel tired, but it's not necessarily something that appears to be ideal for mixing as you go to bed. So, and there's a little bit of I wouldn't say controversy. There's discussion in the literature about this, because you will fall asleep faster if you have some sugar, typically as an adult. Once you've had this big insulin spike, and then you may get a crash, or you may just get like this big anabolic signal from the insulin, and it puts you into parasympathetic tone, and it can help you fall asleep. And so I've actually seen some papers, review papers about sleep in athletes, for example, that recommend a high carbohydrate meal before you go to bed. I fundamentally disagree with this, because we don't eat when we're eating, and insulin and sleep don't work all that great together. And when we're sleeping, that's the time for your growth hormone and testosterone and other things like that to fuel your recovery. Now, having said that, there's a few studies that suggest protein in isolation without carbohydrates prior to bedtime can stimulate some overnight protein synthesis. And, the one study that got a lot of publicity or a lot of attention was, I think there were like 18 to 20 year old males weight training. They were all eating the same thing throughout the day. They were all doing the same training program, but one group was drinking a placebo before they went to bed. The other group was drinking casein before they went to bed. And the casein group had significantly more mass and strength gains after a certain number of weeks of training. Was
protein matched?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I think the meals were matched. I think that protein was extra. So that's another factor.
So yeah, really it could not be the timing, then it could just be the
exactly
protein. Yeah.
And this is also where I'd have to go back and look at that. Super good question. I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's also where this idea that you have to eat casein before you go to bed and take whey after workouts came from, right? You guys have heard that casein is the slow protein. And it doesn't seem to appear like the absorption rate affects the ability of protein as a nutrient to turn on protein synthesis, but that's my interpretation. So the question is, if I was working with him, we'd have to experiment and we'd have to say, what is sleep quality when you do a 4-to-1? And I'd probably start there and then work backwards from there. And I'd go to 2-to-1 and then 1-to-1 and then maybe just straight protein if we need it. Because a big reason why the 4-to-1 is important post-exercise is not that it's replacing carbohydrates. Because like you said, Jonathan, if you take 60 grams of carbs and 15 grams of protein, 60 grams of carbs is a drop in the bucket of what you just burned on a 3-hour zone 2 ride or a threshold workout or something like this, right? It's a drop in the bucket. We're not taking those sugars in the post-exercise state to replace glycogen and do those types of things. What we're doing is taking that bolus of sugar to get an insulin response, because insulin is such a powerful anabolic hormone and it's really important for recovery. And so the idea would be that you would have to find a balance between, okay, how much is my training compromised because I'm a morning person, but I'm forced to train in the evening? How much is my sleep compromised because of the sympathetic nervous system activation? And then what can I get in from a recovery standpoint? And can I give it the 80 or 90 minutes that it probably needs to really come back to baseline before I can go to bed? So if you're training at 8:30 until 10, but you don't have to go to bed until 11:30, you could probably get away with 4-to-1. If you're training till 10 and then you're in bed by 10:30, you're probably going to just be straight protein. It's just going to depend. What I would say is, like, when it comes to these types of things, people really need to recognize who they are individually and then experiment in sort of not super rigid scientific ways, but in thoughtful ways. You can experiment and find out what works. And when you hit on what works, don't be worried that it's not what somebody else does, because like we have to find individual approaches. It's a huge key to unlocking what your potential is within the current constraints of your schedule.
I have a question, like, doesn't whey protein also spike insulin? So for that, like taking it before bed versus carbs. Like, what's the difference in that?
Yeah. So there's a little bit of controversy about this. I would not put it in those terms. I would not say that it spikes insulin. Some studies have shown a little bit of an insulin response in response to just straight whey protein. But in many ways, the impact of those proteins is working independent of insulin. And those, I think, are the more interesting studies. So if you clamp insulin and infuse leucine, for example, you get insulin-independent activation of molecular signals like mTOR. I don't know if you guys have heard of mTOR. It's like an intermolecular signal. So like, there's multiple ways to activate mTOR in the post-exercise state, for example. And it looks like loading with resistance training, for example. We actually don't know exactly what that mechanism is. That there's mechanical signals. So in the absence of nutrient signals, there is an amino acid regulated mTOR activation that works through this RAG protein signaling pathway. And then you have that insulin stimulated mTOR pathway, which works through PI3 kinase and IRS1 and that signal, AKT. These are like famous intermolecular signals that insulin controls. So it's like, if you
they're on the podcast next week.
Coming to a theater near you.
Yeah.
You guys will like this. There's a company that sells antibodies for molecular biology research called Cell Signaling. And you can go to cellsignaling.com and they have this huge database of pathways that they've created. And so you can look at all these intracellular pathways on cellsignaling.com. And when you look at the AKT one, you have AKT in the middle and there's like hundreds of things off of it, right? And one of the most powerful stimulators of AKT is insulin. This is why we take the post-exercise carbohydrate, is to get that insulin response to activate PI3 kinase and AKT signaling, as opposed to just thinking about it in terms of glycogen. I could care less about the glycogen effect on that. We can, sugars are fast acting nutrients, right? And so like, you could not eat a sugar for 6 months and then eat a huge thing of rice covered in honey and maple syrup and your glycogen is back. Like, it happens like that, right? Mm-hmm. So we're more concerned with these signals that can turn on the molecular things that modulate the signals for recovery, et cetera.
That's interesting because, you know, I think we've seen studies of taking the recovery shake. If you're going to train 24 hours later, your glycogen is going to replace. So that's not as important. But what you're saying is it's all about getting that signal. And so what would you, let's say an athlete that is during the day, like they train at 10 or something, versus this athlete who's going to be at night, what would the recovery shake be for, like, let's say some kind of intense workout, threshold workout, something like that?
So like I said, like if we were in the night person, it's trickier because we have multiple things that we're trying to deal with. We're trying to understand, like, what's the sympathetic activation of this? How are we going to come down so we can get the sleep? How fast do we need to fall asleep after that workout takes place? And then I would probably just try. I'd do probably a week at 3-1 and then a week at 2-1. And then I would just look at your Aura or your Whoop or your Apple Watch or whatever and try and figure out, is this like legitimately impacting sleep quality or my heart rate variability or those types of things, right? Heart rate variability would be really useful in this case because heart rate variability is suggestive of parasympathetic versus sympathetic nervous system control, right? When we're under parasympathetic control, we have high heart rate variability. When you're under sympathetic control, you have lower heart rate variability. So the way, just, I know you guys are all familiar with this, but I'll just say, like, if you're running at 120 BPM, it's actually 2 beats per second. If your resting heart rate is in you're sleeping and your resting heart rate is 60 BPM, it's not 1 beat per second. It's your heart rate slows down when you breathe in and it speeds up when you breathe out. And the more variable that is, the higher the variability and the more indicative of parasympathetic and recovery and rest and those types of things. So I'd probably use HRV as an outcome variable for looking at the effectiveness of the different recovery shakes after the night workout and then find out, okay, is this working or is this compromising things too much? But like I said, like if it's the only time you can get it in, you got to get it in. So it just might not be like what is quote unquote ideal if all things were removed and all you could do is just focus on your training. Now, go ahead.
Okay, sorry. The 2-1 2 to 3 to 1. That's carbs to protein.
Yeah, exactly.
Is there a certain amount of protein or carbs that you're trying to hit? Like,
yeah. So it's interesting. And again, this is my interpretation of all these things. I'm just telling you what I think based on what I've read, because there's some controversy about some of this stuff. But from my experience, there's a couple things I misinterpret around this concept. One is that it does seem to be like anywhere from 15 to 20 to 15 to 25 grams of protein, depending on the body size of the individual, is enough to stimulate recovery in the post-exercise state. And here's really the key, if you just remember one thing about this topic, is that that post-exercise drink is not your recovery. It is the initiation of recovery. So when you get essential amino acids in the post-exercise state compared to someone that just takes a placebo, even if you've done the same workout, over the next 48 to 72 hours, you'll typically, I'll say 24 to 72 hours to be safe. Even if those people eat the same thing, they did the same workout, did the same thing, and eat the same thing for the next 24 to 72 hours, the person that took the essential amino acids in the post-exercise state will have higher rates of protein synthesis at serial time points beyond that. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So it's the start of recovery. This is something when you're working with like, you know, new post-collegiate or professionals that are trying to like balance lifestyle and being in their 20s, but also being a professional athlete, this is something you come against because you train hard on Friday, you take your recovery drink, you think, well, that's recovered. And then you go out and drink 12 beers on Friday night, right? That's actually really getting in the way of the prime recovery time from that Friday workout, even though you took your recovery drink. So I'd say 15 to 25 grams is where you want to go. 15 if you're lower body weight, you know, probably anything from 150 and below, you could probably get away with 15 to 20. If you're 150 and above, you probably are looking at 20 to 25 grams. And then the other sort of thing that comes with this is people say, well, you can't absorb protein at greater than amounts of like 25 grams. And so you should never eat more than 25 grams of protein in a single sitting. And like, that's a little bit of a thing that's out there. Like, I thought it was better to eat protein lots of times throughout the day, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. The thing is like, we do absorb that protein and we get access to that protein. But based on my understanding, it's the ability of protein to stimulate protein synthesis tops out at about 25 grams. So if protein synthesis is at 2 and you eat 10 grams of protein, it may make protein synthesis go to 4. But if you eat 20 grams of protein synthesis goes to 8. Okay. But if you eat 30 grams of protein synthesis stays at 8. So, right. So there's a ceiling to what the nutrient protein can do to stimulate protein synthesis. So there's no point in, you can still eat a steak that has 50 grams of protein in it. And that can be, you get access to that protein, but the ability of that protein to turn on protein synthesis caps out. And so the ideal recovery drink, because most people don't want to eat a lot after really hard interval training, you grab 15 to 20 grams of protein, you know, 40 to 60 grams of carbohydrate, and that starts your recovery process. Now, the effect of that on sleep later in the day and those types of things would be TBD for the individual. Some people probably do just fine on it. Other people would probably want to do, I'd probably start with doing less carbohydrate because that protein's super important.
I thought there was just a recent study that had like athletes do 100 grams and then match for like protein, like it was a muscle gain. Yeah. How does that fit in with that?
Yeah. So I'm not super familiar with that study yet. Growth mindset there. But I did have several people text me about that study saying like, hey, like it looks like you could absorb up to 100 grams of protein. And like before I interpret it, I don't want to comment on it yet because I haven't I haven't looked at it in detail yet, but it's something that's like on my million mile to-do list. But
This is super interesting because what you're doing is shifting my mindset, at least, and I'm learning a ton from this conversation. This is awesome. And you're shifting my mindset with my recovery nutrition to go from replenishment to signaling and to focus and to basically send my body the signal that like now is the time to start the recovery process and that it's not just about that energy balance that you're trying to maintain. That's a really interesting perspective.
Cool. Yeah, because energy balance is tricky because people kind of live and die by it. I should use different language. People think about it in too short
they
of
literally
terms.
Do live and die by it.
Kyle was like, maybe I should not go there. And exactly. Nate was like, go hit a home run.
People will die. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. I think a lot of people get to, they think of it too literally like some sort of bank account that always has to have the right balance. And that if you've just did a big ride and you're depleted, there's like this race to get repleted and get your account balance back up to like where you want it to be. And it doesn't really work like that. We work on more of a 24-hour and a weeks and months cycle. So like the things that are really important is that you're getting enough protein on a daily basis and you're getting enough fat on a daily basis. And those are set. And like when I talk to people and do consults with people, I just call them this. These are long-term nutrients. The reason why that makes sense in my head is because like if, Jonathan, if you're like shorting yourself on protein for 4 weeks, it's like a slow knife in the back. It's not like if you go out and you're really depleted of glycogen and you're trying to do a really high intensity workout, which is like something more horrific and like immediate, right? So it's this slow decline that's almost imperceptible. You're not going to feel different tomorrow. You may not feel different the next day, but all of a sudden it's like, I'm not sleeping. I'm not recovering. The thing that I always look for is if workouts are coming too quick. So like, say I do a threshold workout on Tuesday and you're like, I'm glad that's done. And I'm glad I don't have another hard workout till Friday. And then you wake up Friday morning and you're like, it's Friday already and I have to do this like big thing. So when workouts start coming too fast, that's a sign that like either you're not getting enough carbs before these training sessions or you're not getting enough protein throughout the day. And so the 24-hour protein amount and the 24-hour fat amount are critical. And they kind of go hand in hand because if you're eating varied high protein foods, particularly meat, vegetarians have a little bit of a different thing they have to deal with. But if you're getting some meat, you're getting some fat. If you're getting some eggs, you're getting some fat. If you're cooking with butter, you're getting some fat. So the fat usually takes care of itself if the protein amount is where it needs to be. But the thing is like if you go 4 weeks being down on protein and then all of a sudden you're like, oh man, I don't think I've been getting enough protein for the last couple of weeks. I can't just have you eat like a side of a cow and your protein is back, right? And same with fat. You know, there's like whatever, like 14 or 15 steroid-based hormones. Steroid hormones are made from cholesterol. Cholesterol is made from fat. You have to have enough fat, especially if you're low in body fat. You have to get enough fat daily to support all that hormone synthesis and stuff like that. This is especially important for females. Go ahead.
What is enough?
Usually for hard training athletes, 1.2 grams per kilogram body weight for fat. And usually we shoot for a range of anywhere from 1.4 to 1.8 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day. And that can be sort of as low as 1.4 to 1.6 during shoulder season and as high as 1.6 to 2.0 during really heavy periods. The textbook minimum for fat that an athlete gets is 1 gram per kilogram body weight per day. So I usually put a little buffer in there. I go like 1.2 to 1.3 or 4, especially during preseason buildup, stuff like that. And then during race season, you can dial that into 1.0. So yeah, those are good kind of rules of thumb. That's well established. And I like doing that because again, those are those long-term nutrients and you have to get those every 24 hours, regardless of training, right? Like if you're on a rest week and you're doing nothing, you're still hitting that number for protein and that number for fat. So it makes things easy. It makes things straightforward. And as soon as you learn like how many grams of protein, first of all, say you need 110 grams of protein in a day. Well, as soon as I learn how many grams of protein are in the common foods that I eat, I can start to do mental math throughout the day and it becomes pretty straightforward. So it's like, okay, chicken breast has 30 grams, can of tuna has 20 grams, cup of cottage cheese has 18, cup of Greek yogurt has 20, all these different types of things. You also start to realize things like, oh, wow, these almonds aren't a great source of protein, but they're a hell of a source of fat. And I better stop eating almonds thinking that they're protein and start eating them as a supplement to fat, right? And this goes to Jordan's point Where as you're going throughout the day, all of a sudden you realize I'm 30, 40 grams of protein short. Maybe I need to supplement with a shake sometime throughout the day so that I can get a little better at making sure I have this protein number dialed.
Man, this is so much helpful information. Like, okay. Nate,
would you flex then the rest of the calories for your day with like the carbohydrate?
Exactly. And those modulate based on training. Mm-hmm. The thing with this is that it's all about the carbohydrates preceding workouts. And this is a big shift. This is my approach. I could care less if you ate a lot of pancakes after you did a 4-hour ride. What I want is you to eat a lot before the 4-hour ride because that's where you need the energy, right? And so to go back to that balance question and that sort of where am I? Am I repleted? Am I depleted? And stuff like that. You're always going to be taken care of with fat and protein because those are set every day. And then with carbohydrates, you would, like if you're going to think about it in that acute day-by-day sense, you're going to overeat the day before a big training and probably make up with undereating after that training. But you're going to overeat before your next key training session. So it doesn't matter if you're underfueled for that day. And it sort of all balances out. This approach seems to work pretty well because a few meals before a really key training session, you should be thinking about loading up on carbohydrates. You know, a normal size male cyclist, 150, 160, 170 can store, I don't know, it's really variable, but 500 to 800 grams of glycogen. Possibly. Like that's a ton of rice, right? To try and get in one meal pre-ride. And so you have to build that up over a couple meals. And you're constantly using your liver glycogen and all these different types of things. And you're moving around throughout the day and you're using carbs because it's convenient and to your muscles and these types of things. So the point is that you need to eat several meals of carbohydrates before key workouts. You need to get your recovery drink after that workout. And then it's less important to get a lot of carbs after that workout, even if you're in a deficit, because you're probably in an quote unquote excess from prior to that. It's a little bit new. Because most coaches and most people just preach replenish, replenish, replenish. And this is more load up, load up, load up. And like, as long as you're getting your protein and fat out and sufficient calories overall, you're not in relative energy deficiency, then I could care less if you ate a lot after training's over. The important thing is training.
I love this. So what we have is maybe you'll have like a, let's say on a Tuesday, you have a hard day, like hard threshold day. Wednesday could be an easy day, aerobic.
Exactly.
And what a lot of people could do is they say, well, on that Wednesday, I'm not going to eat any carbohydrate because I didn't actually need a lot.
Well, on Monday.
I'm saying what people do, what they think. So not what you're suggesting. So Tuesday's hard. Yeah. Wednesday, they're doing an easy day. So they're like, I'm going to go low carb. And then
on which Thursday, day? Tuesday or Wednesday?
On Wednesday.
Yeah.
And then on Thursday, they have like a morning hard workout. And they said, I'm going to eat a piece of toast before my workout and go, and then eat some carbs during the workout.
Yeah. Workout's no good.
No good. Right. So on that Wednesday, when it's the easy day,
you got to load up. Yeah.
You got to load up. Yes. Yeah, thank you. This is what I've been preaching for years on this podcast. I'm so happy. Yeah.
<It's awesome>. Like, yeah.
Yeah. So like if you train hard on this is why, and cyclists do this a little bit more. So it's different for runners because the pounding, the gravitational load that is placed on the body is just so different than on cycling. So, you know, cyclists do a lot more blocks in the middle of the week where you're doing either back-to-back days or you only have one down day between two really hard days. And, you know, workouts are typically like threshold hit, like these types of things, race simulations, hill repeats, those sorts of things. I also include the long rides in workouts. Like they're just that's just a big metabolic stress. So like if you talk about Keegan, he does that. What's that famous ride down in Arizona on Saturdays?
The shootout.
Yeah. This is like crazy. And so like he has to start eating for the shootout on Thursday night. Right. And then I'm less concerned with what he does on Sunday and Monday, but he has, or sorry, on Sunday. But starting on Monday, if he's going to have back-to-back days on Tuesday and Wednesday or back-to-back days on Wednesday, Thursday, I think that's kind of the way things go. He usually does 2 or 3 days in the middle of the week. So it's a little bit different than the runners who are like Tuesday, Friday, Sunday. which means that Monday, Thursday, Saturday are high carb days and the other days are less carbs. Wednesday is the only true day when you're not kind of thinking about, you're in low carb mode coming off the workout Tuesday and you're not having to be in high carb mode for a workout Thursday because your workout's not till Friday. So that's your one day where you can stay low carb for like more than 24 hours, basically.
So you're kind of like, as you would carb load for a race, that's what you're constantly doing for these small workouts. You're thinking about that.
Because, and loading, loading, loading. Like it's this interesting phenomenon that I noticed early on when I started working with athletes, especially elite athletes. I would say, well, what do you eat before workout? So I eat oatmeal. I do this. I just get kind of whatever. And then I go for a ride. I say, okay, well, what do you do before races? And they say, oh, and they have this really intricate plan, right? And I was like, well, how do you typically feel during races? And they're like, oh, I usually feel awesome. And I have a lot of energy. And it's like, how do you feel in workouts? And it's like, oh, it's hit and miss. And it's like, I think I know why. Like, so let's create consistency around. The other thing about creating consistency with like pre-ride meals should be the same every time for a workout as it is a race. Because again, those are signals that are saying it's go time and we got to get ready to go and this is go time. And so, and the timing should be similar and to your warm up and all this stuff should be similar because as everyone knows, when you race, there's a lot more things. One, you're typically in an unfamiliar environment. Two, a lot of times you didn't sleep in your own bed. I guess that goes, that's 1A. Two, you're really keyed up and nervous and your blood flow to your stomach is different and those types of things. So the more that you can do that's consistent to what you do on a daily basis is really, really critical. So like when our athletes go to international competitions, for instance, their whole pre-race routine, because of the increased security and call room and TV schedule, and they may warm up and then get called back and go sit under the stadium for 20 minutes before they go out to the track and run an all-out 1500, right? Well, what can you do? You do your warm up, you do your activations on the track, and then you sit for 20 minutes before you do your workout. It's those types of things you can really be creative about how you build that in. And again, I don't, if you're going out to an enduro race and you're sleeping on the ground, like you don't need to like sleep on your thermarest in your bedroom in the weeks leading up to it. But the point is you're sort of mentally prepared for it. These are the check marks and these, I know my stomach does well on this. I mean, kind of following that pre-race routine on a more regular basis, I think is really important.
So we get a question a lot. We're talking a lot about carbs and sugar and eating probably sugar while you work out. And everyone says, you know, sugar makes you fat. Sugar gives you cancer. Yeah. What you're expert, and I guess I saw too in cancer too.
Yeah.
What concerns should athletes have? Like, will it make them fat? If they take in gels during their workouts, are they going to have cancer later from what we've, you know, you see in media all the time?
Yeah. So I think this is a really interesting question and this will be an ongoing discussion, I think, if we get the opportunity to do this again, because this is more than just it's not a quick answer, but the quick answer is overwhelmingly probably not. And like I'm very, very confident in saying that, which is a little bit of a hedge, but I'm like, you know, classically trained scientist. Like it's important to not speak in absolutes.
Yeah.
But a lot of that information comes from association studies, right? So the idea where you're just tracking sugar consumption in the population and you're tracking cancer rates in the population, and then you're conflating those two things. Not to say that there's no relationship between those two things whatsoever. In some cases, there are. But in this instance, just putting blanket categorizations of this is bad because these two things rose at the same time. What's been really interesting to see is, I can't remember if it's sugar overall or high fructose corn syrup, but for a really long time in the 90s and in the 2000s, when I was like in school and grad school, everyone gave these talks and they would plot the relationship between sugar consumption, it's either sugar consumption and high fructose corn syrup consumption and obesity rates. And it's like a 1-to-1 ratio. It's a really tight line, right? Regression line. And it goes out and they say, now we can't say that these two things, but don't you think it's interesting that this line is so tight? Yeah. Okay. Well, the last like 8 years, sugar consumption has flatlined or even gone down, which overall I think is a good thing societally. Obesity rates just keep climbing. Right. So all of a sudden, yeah, it turns out that that perfect little story, you don't see that graph too much anymore at the intro of talks about the causes of obesity and the policy changes we need to make around certain things, stuff like that. Not suggesting that all sugar is totally fine or that high fructose corn syrup, that should actually be avoided at all kind of costs. So yeah, there's just a lot to unpack with this. The other thing is that when we're exercising, we're in a catabolic state. And when you're in a catabolic state, you're in a state where you're utilizing nutrients for fuel production. So eating a lot of sugar while we're exercising is not really contributing to growth signaling or the types of things that would be associated with cancer. If you think about cancer at its base, most basic sense, it's uncontrolled cell growth. Well, uncontrolled cell growth requires a lot of energy. Uncontrolled cell growth requires a lot of effort. It requires a lot of vasculature and blood flow and all these different things that are anabolic processes. Well, when we're exercising, we're in a catabolic process. And there's all kinds of exokines that are getting released and hormones from your skeletal muscle and different places and your central nervous system's involved. And we're utilizing those sugars as an energy source, right? And we are more insulin sensitive in the post-exercise state, which is why daily exercise is super, super important for just overall health. We're kind of mixing training and performance with just general health. But then also, like, people that exercise more have less rates of cancer. They tolerate chemo better. They have better quality of life during survivorship. There was just an ACSM statement, consensus statement about exercise with cancer during treatment and post-treatment. There's all these benefits to exercising. And exercising at a really high level requires carbohydrates. It's the way our body is built. It just does. Now, you can, to a certain degree, become fat adapted, which is like a whole nother topic. And but you can never become so fat adapted that you can use fat as efficiently as you can carbohydrates. It's rocket fuel. It's the way it is. And we have all these hormonal systems and biological systems around the idea of taking advantage of when we get access to sugar, right? Because we did evolve as meat eaters, and that was our primary source, but we're also omnivores, right? We eat a lot of carbohydrates, and then we developed an agrarian society. There's a bunch of like stuff in the fossil record that, again, like this, we could go like really, but overall, with a really active lifestyle and thoughtful consumption, particularly around carbohydrates and sugar, sugar does appear to be very safe. Now, the other side of that, where you have to manage this, is that, for example, we say, okay, you have to carb up for three meals before a really hard workout. Well, because we know at rest, when we consume carbohydrates, that we have a glycemic response and we have insulin that's released. And we know that insulin stimulates growth and promotes growth and tissue, like anabolic processes, glycogen storage. It also suppresses fat breakdown and it promotes fat storage, right? So this is one of the issues of just saying, well, I need 500 grams of carbs before this workout. So I'm getting 100 grams of carbs of gels for 5 hours leading up to that workout. That's not a good strategy day in and day out because you're constantly eating really high glycemic sugars that are spiking your glucose because you're at rest. They're spiking your insulin because you're at rest, and they're promoting fat storage, and they're promoting, they're suppressing fat synthesis, and they're stressing your insulin system. And this is where you get into things like type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance and weight gain and those types of things. And the reason why people gain weight on excess caloric diets that are characterized by high carbohydrate is because there's this thing called the hierarchy of substrate metabolism, where your body, if carbs are available, your body will burn them. And so even if we're sitting here podcasting, and if we all ate pancakes right now, our fat use would go down, our RER would go, or our RQ would go way up, our lactate production would go up, because we're flooding this pathway that your body likes to use, even though under these circumstances, it's not the most efficient use of your body's fuel sources, we know that fat is the most efficient use when we're at rest. Okay. So if you're constantly eating carbs all the time throughout the day, completely random times, and you're eating high glycemic carbs, then you're constantly spiking blood sugar, you're constantly spiking insulin, and this is where you get into trouble because you potentially are in excess caloric consumption. You're suppressing fat use. The carbs don't turn into fat in humans. They do in the liver to a certain extent, but we don't turn carbs into fat very well as humans. But they promote fat gain because we're constantly suppressing fat use because we're constantly having insulin up throughout the day, right? And so there's real kind of thought and intention that goes into how many times am I going to spike insulin today, right? Breakfast, lunch, dinner, and maybe post-exercise. So 4 max, or at least one of my post-exercise meals will be really low in carbohydrates because I know that I'm not going to have a hard training day the next day and I can get away with a little bit less of an insulin spike because of this, right? And so you want to be really intentional with when I eat carbohydrates, are these high glycemic or complex carbohydrates with fiber and those types of things? Is it the meal before workout? Because I don't want a bunch of waterlogged fiber in my colon while I'm working out. So I'm going to eat a little more of a simple complex carbohydrate. I'm going to eat simple carbs on the bike and not worry too much about the glycemic index of those because I'm in a catabolic state. And then
you
away
do
from
worry about them. You want it to be high.
You want them. You want them. Yes. You want them. Yeah. I'm not going to worry about the detrimental, supposed detrimental effects of them. And then outside of that, you're really going to be intentional with your meal times in order to get the carbs that you need. But maybe you're eating them with complex meals and it's pasta with a protein, with a bunch of raw vegetables. And now all of a sudden, just that pasta alone, which might cause a big glucose spike, is now reduced because you're eating it in a mixed meal. And so overall, carbs are necessary for high performance. They're not labeled as carcinogenic, but there is an association with the overconsumption of carbs and repeated spikes in carbs throughout the day. If you're drinking Gatorade because you're thirsty, that's a completely unnecessary spike in carbohydrates that may over time lead to weight gain, contribute to things like insulin resistance, and potentially have detrimental health outcomes and effects. Now, the other side of this is that we do want to manage and control those things because there are studies when I was at USC, I worked with a gentleman named Walter Longo, who's kind of like the father of intermittent fasting. And we did a couple projects together around the idea of like what biochemical signals and molecular signals are altered in different fed or fasted states and how may that impact cancer progression or potentially resistance to chemotherapy or different things like this. And he's published a bunch of really interesting papers on this topic. And one of his really interesting papers was he actually collaborated with a group in Ecuador where they went down and found an indigenous population, a small kind of homogeneous population with a really high rate of dwarfism. The higher rate of dwarfism is caused by a defect in IGF-1 signaling. IGF-1 is made from the liver and it's stimulated by growth hormone. So it works a little bit differently than insulin, but it has similar effects. It can turn on AKT and growth signaling. It promotes cell division, all these different types of things. And what they found is that the individuals with dwarfism in this population of people had far less type 2 diabetes, obesity, insulin resistance, cancer incidence. And it seemed that as adults, reduced growth signaling does appear to be effective in some ways. And this is one of the benefits of like intermittent fasting, for example. So you fast 24 hours once a week, that's enough time for IGF-1 and growth hormone, some other growth signals to come down. Your body's cells go into like this sort of housekeeping mode where they organize themselves, they take out the trash, there's some autophagy changes, there's different things that occur. And so that can be really healthy. And definitely someone that is like suffering from cancer or is at risk for cancer, having a lower sugar diet can be really quite beneficial because you're not randomly spiking these growth signals. You're trying to prevent the overabundance of growth signals. But when you're in this state of massive flux where you're training for 20 or 25 or even up to 30 hours a week, and you're in a massive caloric, you're putting this massive caloric demand on, and you have this really high performance thing going on, under those like circumstances, you know, carefully choosing your meal timing around complex carbohydrates and utilizing simple sugars while you're on the bike seem to be good for performance. They seem to be good for recovery, and they don't seem to be detrimental in terms of like the risk for these types of things. So a lot of these just blanket statements about like sugar causes cancer, and so we have to stop eating sugar and we have to find different ways to fuel on the bike, they're ignoring the fact that we're complex biological systems that go through a lot of different states, and they're kind of conflating two different states. You know, if a soccer mom calls me, I use that term endearingly. My wife is a soccer mom. So if a soccer mom calls me and says like, I'm not saying, hey, do a 4-to-1 carbohydrate to protein ratio and eat 2 cups of rice at every meal, 3 meals leading up to your 30 minutes on the elliptical machine Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. That's not the way this is working. That's just good, like, maintenance. The context, you know, for a lot of this audience is like high performance. High performance is just different. And you can be healthy and be high performance. It's just different.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was really long.
No, I want to summarize some stuff. So on the bike, do what we're doing already. Eat those high glycemic things. Leading up before it, eat a fast acting carb, maybe some oatmeal or some toast with honey or something like that. And then before that, eat your carbs that are like wrapped in fiber, or have your carbs with protein and fat mixed inside meals. That meal. Yeah. So like I'm talking about like whole foods, berries, stuff like that, legumes. This is what I've been saying for years. So I'm like, okay, happy to be getting this. One other thing you said, though, is that you said that the high sugar diet could lead to weight gain.
Yeah,
Could it be more like body composition changes where you're more fat rather than lean, where weight gain would just be a caloric excess? So if things were matched.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So if we run it back.
There's a little bit of difference between that.
Yeah. I mean, if we run it back, I'm almost sure I said, if you have a high carbo diet with sort of a lot of random carbohydrate spikes along with caloric excess.
Along with caloric excess, yes.
Yeah. So a lot of this comes from liquid calories, right? Because we don't process liquid calories the same way that we bypass our hunger signals. We do all this stuff. So hard training is actually a really powerful hunger suppressant, which is why we use post-exercise drinks, because it's the only thing people want to get down within the first 5 minutes of indeed a really hard workout, right? Nobody wants a Thanksgiving dinner 5 minutes after they've finished their cool down. This can become very useful or useful information because, like, for example, like smoothies can have a lot of healthy nutrients, but they bypass all our hunger signals. They don't fill you up. They don't make you feel full. They don't keep you full for very long. And they just add a bunch of calories to the system that aren't really detected from the signals that are released when we chew, when we machinate food in our stomach, all those different types of things. So those mixed meals you're talking about, yeah, they're going to have higher fiber carbohydrates, or even like if you're leading into a big race or a really key workout, you can eat white rice. Right? But white rice and chicken is not going to have as big a glycemic index as white rice alone or white rice with syrup. And then pre-exercise, you mentioned one thing. I really look for lower fiber type complex carbs in those scenarios because the fiber, you know, we don't absorb it for energy, and especially soluble fiber that comes from grain fiber. So these types of things can cause like stomach issues and stuff like that. That's just a little thing to keep in mind.
Yeah. What's a good source of that?
Mm-hmm. So we know because Keegan is famous for it. So yeah, exactly. Like, right. Cause that's complex, but, and it has a feeling of fullness and you actually have to chew it, but it's very easy to digest and it's low in fiber, and you can add however much extra sugar you need with syrup, but the syrup doesn't have high fructose corn syrup in it, which gets trapped in our liver and we don't get access to it anyways. So this is the other thing to remember when you're, you know, we talked about being on the bike and eating those high glycemic sugars, but not all these things are created equal. You know, like Coca-Cola tastes so good sometimes on a long, hot ride, but you have to get the glass bottle Coca-Cola that's made with real sugar, because the plastic bottle Coca-Cola that's made with high fructose corn syrup, you don't get access to those carbohydrates because the majority of them get trapped in your liver. And that's because we express this enzyme in our liver that holds on to fructose at a higher degree than glucose. And all our nutrients pass through our liver before they go out to the rest of our body. So liver is the king. It gets first pass nutrient uptake.
But
so,
when you're working out though, are you taking in fructose though? And some of these gels have fructose.
Yeah, of course. Because a mixture of sugars at a low fructose when you put a little bit of fructose and you put a variety of chain length sugars into it, then you utilize more of your sugar receptors in your small intestine. Yeah, you have a much better absorption. And the price you pay is that, yes, 70% of the fructose that you consume gets trapped in the liver. But the percentage of the fructose that you're consuming is so small that it doesn't really make a difference. You're using the fructose to optimize sugar absorption. This research goes back quite a way. So you guys are familiar with it, right? If you combine different types of sugars, you get more sugar in your bloodstream. Well, that's because more sugar made it through your stomach, through your gut, through your portal circulation, through your liver, and has now gotten to your finger where you take your little finger prick and you see the, right? But if you take something like Gatorade, which has a really actually nice, well-researched, I know that's sacrilegious, but has like a lot of research behind the combinations of sugar they use. And you compare it with something like Coke or Arizona iced tea or something. This is a fun experiment to do. We do it in our exercise physiology class where we'll have someone drink the exact same amount of carbohydrate in those two, but then we take cereal finger pricks and look at the difference in blood glucose between the different drinks. And when you have tons of fructose in one of them, you get less of a glycemic response. And you may think, well, that's great. I don't want a high glycemic response. Well, you also don't want a lot of fructose flooding your biochemical pathways in your liver, because a lot of excess fructose does get converted into fat. It can contribute to non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. There's different reasons why we don't want to. But fructose, like naturally occurring fructose in fruits and a mixture of fructose to increase sugar absorption in the drinks that you make or the drinks that you buy, is a beneficial thing when you're on the bike.
This is awesome.
Okay.
This is, we're not going to get into more questions today. It does not matter. Okay. This is wonderful. Yeah. So,
okay, cool.
Okay. So I want to clarify one thing. Let's say I'm taking in a drink with 2-to-1 glucose to fructose. That's a really common thing that people take in, whether they make it or whether they buy it. There's a lot of products with that.
Yeah.
When you stated the fact of having excess fructose in your liver, if you're taking in something like 120 grams of carbs per hour, are you in an active state as you are when you're training?
Yeah.
Are you, I guess, entering some sort of danger zone with putting in too much fructose into that liver?
That's a super good question. I don't 100% know. Yeah, that's a really good question.
And the role, because
there's evidence. One of the things that we know, like a high fructose diet in animals, for example, a high fructose diet can contribute to fat accumulation in non-adipose tissue. So it gets converted in animals do this better than we do, but we do it pretty well in the liver. And so one of the things, there is an association between excess fructose consumption and fat accumulation in the liver. But exercise does appear to be beneficial in instances of people with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And non-alcoholic fatty liver disease does appear to be more prevalent in sedentary individuals than exercising individuals. So kind of thinking along, and I'm just spitballing here, I don't know this, but thinking along those lines, I could see there being some sort of change in flux under those hard exercising conditions. I'm sure someone's like looked at it, but we'd have to go look for the paper or the abstract or whatever to find out if someone looked at fructose flux in the liver while exercising. Super interesting question. Yeah, so I don't know.
Yeah. So high fructose corn syrup, I think it's like 55% fructose and then 45% glucose, right? And then I just did the math. So for a 12-ounce Coke, that's 39 grams of sugar. So around, I think it's like, 21, 22 grams of fructose.
Mm-hmm.
If you're like a Keegan, you're getting 120 grams of carbs an hour, you know, on a bike, you might be able to then have a Coke and then have some other gels that are just glucose and combine that and kind of get the right ratio.
That's interesting.
Optimum.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Because I know what Ironman athletes do is they'll have like a little bit of cup of flat Coke while they run, but maybe 2 or 3 ounces and then have other gels. And I'd worry about, they'd say, I'm not gonna be able to use these carbs at all. But it's really, I think what you're talking about is an excess of fructose.
This is super interesting. So there's this weird thing with especially ultra athletes that Coke just tastes awesome. And it does seem to play nice with the stomach 10 hours in, 12 hours in, 15 hours in. And I don't discourage it. It just sort of is what it is. But I would use it more for that signaling. Like when I drink Coke, I feel better. And it's probably a combination of the sugar, the caffeine, something in it that is the mental association with it. I'm not sure exactly all the things, but I don't want to get too much of breaking it down into its just base components. So you could get away with like a really cold bottle of Coke. And then, yeah, you could supplement with different gels and things like that. I don't think it would like completely derail you. You wouldn't want to fuel your whole effort off of Coke.
Oh, yeah, because it would be too much.
Yeah.
Okay.
For sure.
Does that make sense? I'm hedging a little bit because there's these practical things, you know, like I've worked with some really high level ultra athletes, like so Caitlin Boyle is one of my athletes, and so is Katie Scheid. She won UTMB a couple of years ago. She's a trail runner, and there are certain times where flat Coke just tastes awesome, and we don't like run away from that because of this thing, right? So there's the practical side of it. But if you're making gas station stops, you know, there's certain things that you want to go for and certain things that you want to avoid. Yeah.
Oh man, that could be a fantastic bit of content there.
Yeah. Corn dogs. Right? Like,
exactly. Yeah. Don't listen, earmuffs.
People have different people have different needs. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So I think I was wondering is that if fructose was just matched, so we pay all this money for gels, right, John, that are super expensive for a certain ratio of glucose to fructose.
And usually, commonly, really quick, Nate, it's like 1 to 0.8 is what you typically see in a lot of gels right now. One part glucose to every 0.8 parts fructose.
Yeah.
And if, let's say, the stomach issue, there was no stomach issues aside, right?
Yeah.
If we were to get the fructose through fructose corn syrup, and so the ratios were the same and we could digest them just as well.
Yeah.
Would there be something inherently wrong with high fructose corn syrup than me just having like a bottle where I put fructose in it and glucose?
Yeah, this is interesting. I don't know. I'd have to think about this. The way it's made sense in my mind in the past is one, like I actually prefer the supplements with a variety of chain size as opposed to just glucose and fructose, because glucose and fructose can be different, but when you get different chain sizes, so amylopectin versus like these different things, right? So I know Martin does stuff with that, Never Second does stuff with that, so does Precision Hydration. There's also Now Sports is a company that makes you can just buy like amylopectin powder. So you can basically create your own different things. And in terms of digestibility, there's these issues with putting too much of one thing into the gut and creating kind of traffic jams at the receptors that let those things through. And I don't know if there's just one thing that would work for everybody to say, like, you do this and you're in the clear and it doesn't matter where it comes from. I'm really hesitant to sort of say it doesn't matter where it comes from. Variety seems to be the best. So most of the products that seem to play the nicest with, and it sounds like Jonathan knows more about the ratios than I do. I basically go based off of, and this makes me, I'll probably lose some credibility here, but it's like what seems to work most often for most athletes. And we try a few things and then we find out what works. And most of the athletes I work with are in an advantageous position because as soon as they find what they like, they just reach out to the company and say, hey, I want to use this product. And they get support from them a lot of times, not always. The idea, I guess, would be like lengths, ratios, salt, and dilution. And what combination of those things plays most nice with your stomach?
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I would go, because the salt's really important, not just from a sodium loss from sweat standpoint, but also it aids in co-transportation and getting glucose across the intestinal membrane. and then or sugars across the intestinal membrane. And then it's more for like how much fluid does whatever combination you've settled on draw to the stomach? How much gut motility does it do? How much does it play nice with your stomach? And so I think like trying a bunch of different products in a bunch of different ways. So if we use Keegan for an example, and I don't think he'll mind me kind of using him as an example, I've never met someone that can eat more sweet stuff than him in my entire, I've never come across an athlete in 10 years that has the tolerance of a sweet tooth that he has. I remember when he was with Goo, or when he was using Goo products, they came out with a flavor that was like birthday cake flavor, I think. Oh, yeah, it was like
for kids.
Personally, it was one of the most disgusting things I've ever done. I think that's all he ate when he Everested during COVID, when he set the FKT for Everest. I'm pretty sure he did the whole thing off this massive cache of 127 birthday cake goose. Like it was an insane amount. So different people have different capacities for different things. You know, with Kate, with Caitlin, for example, she's always bike packing and you can't eat gels for like days at a time or for, well, Keegan can, when he did the Arizona 24 hour race,
a couple hours in El Pueblo.
Right? That was a couple years ago when I think he broke the course record in that race. And when we debriefed after that, he was like, dude, that was as much of an eating contest as it was a cycling contest. And, but we even for him, we had to mix it up. We had to get some broth in there and he was having a cup of noodles and he was doing different things because even he had his limits. I'm hedging a lot here, but it's just so individual that I'm really hesitant to just say like, yeah, mix these things together and that's your new ideal sports drink.
Yeah, sure.
Sorry.
Man, I actually think it builds your credibility in the sense that you willingness to say that I don't know is something that's pretty rare these days. so yeah, super appreciate it. I don't want to take up any more of your time. This is more than we bargained for. And Kyle, I appreciate it so much. We have so many.
We didn't get through many of these questions. There's some really good ones too. Like
I'm going to save them.
I mean, we can. Yeah. If you guys are up for it, we can do this again. It's a lot of fun.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Okay,
Kyle, is there, I mean, you're an associate professor and you do these sort of things. And I know that your client list is full too, but like, I don't, is there anything you want to promote or do you anything you want people to do as a result of listening to this?
Oh man, that's such a good question. I'm like, this is the thing that I'm the absolute worst at is self-promotion or any type of promotion. I mean, like what I would do is deflect and say, you know, give attention to the athletes that I work with. They're amazing. Like the Brooks Beast, you can follow them on Instagram. You know, of course, like I work with Kate Courtney and I've worked with Alex Wild and I've had a couple meetings with Chris Melman. I know you guys know him and Keegan and I've worked with Chris Blevins before and they're like such phenomenal athletes. The way that you can follow along with people's kind of journey right now is pretty cool. Like Caitlin is a really cool example of that. You know, she won 24-hour worlds, got in a horrific car accident, and now is basically like invented this new type of backcountry sponsored supported athlete, which is awesome. Yeah. So follow, you know, give support to the athletes and Brooks. I don't really work with any company specifically. At some point I am a scientific advisor for a sleep mask company called Lumos. I'll give them a little plug. Cool. And if you go to Lumos Sleep, I think it's lumos.tech, or you put in Lumos sleep mask, and it's based on one of my colleagues that I worked with at USC did her postdoc at Stanford in like, she's the smartest person I've ever met. So she left USC. She went for a postdoc to do individualized cancer therapies for people based on genomic analysis, like whole genome analysis. And that apparently wasn't keeping her busy or stimulated enough. So she joined a young entrepreneurial group at Stanford. They built a product based on decades of research from this gentleman named Dr. Jamie Zeitzer, who's out of Stanford, who's basically demonstrated that the non-image forming cells in our retinas that respond to light through our closed eyelids can be activated with micropulses of light And that can completely shift somebody's circadian rhythm. So this is bringing the conversation full circle. So she and a couple people, and now she's the founder and CEO, she's invented this sleep mask. And I help with, because we combine it with nutrition, and athletes use it when they go overseas to train and things like that. And basically what it does is it utilizes those light impulses to alter your circadian rhythm to your destination, kind of no matter where you go in the world, whether it's three time zones or... So we work with the WNBA, we work with the military, we work with a lot of firefighters and shift workers and things like that, because the mask has the capability of like altering people's circadian rhythm in a way that can adjust it to their daily schedule. The mask also has a sunrise feature. So you're laying there with a mask on and an orange light slowly comes on for 20 minutes before you have to get up. And even when you wake up, you just lay there, kind of feel the light through your eyelids. And then when you take the mask off, you're awake. You like come out of that. That's that melatonin coming down, cortisol coming up thing. So yeah, sorry. I'll give them a plug. That's cool. Guys would be super interested in it.
You just sold a lot of them.
Yeah. It's very, yeah, it's a super cool startup. And Bichuan Liu is the founder's name. And she's a colleague and a friend of mine. And we've been working together on it a couple of years. And one of their big breaks came from a grant from NASA, because they wanted to be able to get astronauts on particular circadian rhythms when they were in space or traveling to different places and stuff like that. So it's a super cool, yeah, it's a super cool product.
Lumos.tech.
Yep, Lumos.tech. Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Kyle. If you're listening to this right now and you appreciated this episode, you've appreciated Kyle's time and all of his amazing insight, thumbs up, please, on the YouTube video. If you're and subscribe on whatever channel you're using. Submit your questions. We have a list of them to get through, Kyle. So we have to do another one here. But submit questions if you have them for Kyle or any general training topic at trainerroad.com/podcast or on Spotify. And sign up for Trainer Road. Makes you faster. Nate, we're almost to 18,000 reviews, I saw, on the App Store. 4.9 star rating. Pretty darn awesome. So
that's amazing.
Yeah, pretty great. All right, we'll talk to you all next week. Thanks a bunch.
All right, see ya.
Bye.
Thanks, guys.